Where were we?
We're back on the air.
Back on the air. Did you start it again?
Yeah, it's
okay.
Recording.
Okay.
Okay. So you said you grew up in Kaimuki.
Yeah, I did.
What do you think about the relationship of this fish pond to Kane'ohe, or its importance of being in Kane'ohe?
Ah, I think it's important.
Because you live right across.
Yeah, I live over there. So I moved into that home. We finally bought our home in 98. So we moved into that home in Yacht Club Terrace, right? I can see the yacht club, all the ships right now. Just on the other side of that yacht club is our Yacht Club Terrace where we live since 98. But I didn't leave KCC until 2016, right, when I got the job at Windward. So I grew up in Kaimuki. I went to KCC, Kaimuki High, then KCC, and then UH Manoa. And then... But I was bringing people from town to this fish pond, right? Because I was working at KCC.
Wow.
And I was telling them to come out here for service learning, to come out here for the service. So it's more than just a Kane'ohe thing, right?
Yeah.
I would argue that a lot of people who live in Kane'ohe know about this fish pond because either one of their kids or themselves came on some kind of a work day with the school or on a Saturday. So lots of people kind of have had their hands in this pond and have worked here. So I think people in general know about this pond as sort of that educational experience. Mm-hmm. Anybody's welcome on the Saturdays. You can come. And then I think other people from beyond Kane'ohe know about it because us teachers would bring them out. So like my teacher that I was working alongside, Nelda Quincel, she taught botany. And she was bringing her students out here on service learning. And then the other person that would bring her students here, she taught cultural anthropology. Ula Hassinger. She taught cultural anthropology, and she and Nelda kind of started the service learning program, and so she would bring her students out here. They're all from, Ula's students were actually from not just KCC, but she also taught at UH Manoa and she taught at Chaminade, right? So she would have multiple students coming here, and she would always kind of, I'd often serve as her rep to just sign off on forms because if she couldn't be here because she had another one going on at the same day. They often were busy every Saturday because they had different events going on. So this pond is not just important to Kane'ohe. I would argue it's important to the island, and more people from throughout the island has come here than to, let's say, He'e'ia or to other fish ponds that are.
Yeah.
Because other fish ponds have more limited access, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But this fish pond has been known for, this is where you come for your classes. We're always welcome to bring your classes here, to have your students do service learning here. So I think it's more than just Kane'ohe. And I like that over the years, over all these years, there's so many work days that all those many, many hands have been involved in this pond. So I'm just thinking of all the years, even since I've been involved in 2006, there must be kids who have grown up now and they remember coming as a kid to the pond, right? And that means that if they remember coming as a kid to the pond, it means that the next generation will probably remember too, right? Because they'll pass it on and they'll bring their kids. And I've worked many work days where we had families coming, right? Because Kamehameha schools would have that requirement where parents have to go do work days with their kids. I don't know how many service hours they had to do. Sometimes they were very enthusiastic, sometimes they were not. But they would be here with the whole family. And the kids loved it. And it's like, what an excuse to come outside, get all muddy and dirty, and it's okay to get muddy and dirty, and your parents are part of it. You don't have the cell phones, you don't have the earphones, you don't have the squares and the electronic stuff, and you're actually doing something together as a family, right? So those were always fun times when the families would come. Yeah, and they go, oh, I remember I came when I was a kid, right?
And right, and that kind of fits into what Herb was saying about the seventh generation.
Right, we are passing it on, and the more kids come out here, the more they're going to remember it, and if they remember it, and even one time here, they will likely preserve it. So in the future, going forward, they will pass it on to their kids, or they'll bring their kids out. Oh, we got to go do one day at Waikolua, right? Just so they know. And so it's just kind of amazing, this pond. It's just sort of addictive, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't visited much Lokoi'a here on Oahu, but...
In Kane'ohe, I think we only have the...
This one,
He'e'ia. We have Kahana, I think, has theirs, right? And then we have out in... is it Moli'i? The one out in that's owned by the ranch out there, Ko'olo'a Ranch. They own a private pond, right? And so I think He'e'ia and the one out in the Ko'olo'a Ranch, those ones try to produce food, fish, right?
Yeah.
Ours, not so much, right? We had so much sediment. We had so much sort of you know, there's that stream on that side that was most polluted, right? That stream just on the other side of the pond. So it's more of an educational pond rather than
just
making
looking
fish.
At it has the space, to hold a lot of people, volunteers, helpers.
So what I was just heard Herb say when we walked out to the Makaha out there, when we're walking on the wall, he was saying that they got to remove a whole bunch of sediment in the pond. A lot of sediment has washed in, right? So it's just so deep. So if you walk in, you're sinking down to your knees or whatever, right? It's really deep.
Yeah.
So you got to remove a lot of that sediment, I guess, before you can make it a productive pond again. Yeah. And I don't think we have fresh water coming in, because normally it's supposed to be brackish, right? You get the fresh water with the ocean water mixing. But we've cut off the fresh water supply for quite a number of years. It doesn't have that kind of mix anymore. Mm. The stream doesn't flow into the pond. So I think, when he says seven generations, there's multiple things that need to be done over time. But because I think so many kids have been here, so many families have been here, so many people have been here over the years, I think, and because now we own it, I think it's the only owned pond that's privately owned, right? It's nonprofit owns it. It's the Pacific American Foundation owns it. So that's pretty cool. That means it's always protected. And maybe one day we can get fish in there again.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. Except for the big crabs we pulled out, or the eels that are in there, or the, what is it, barracuda that they had in there? You kind of.
Barracuda?
I think so. You got to go look at the list of the fish. Was it long one? That's the long one that comes and he goes, Right. Because the predators can get in, because it's not yet your official Makaha. We're keeping them out. Mm. So it's not functioning like a fish pond should function, right? It's been changed over the years.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly... we can't raise fish just yet, right? Not the regular
one. Not this generation.
Not this generation. Maybe the next. Maybe the next one. Could be. Okay.
I think you kind of touched on this next question, but... How have you seen the Lukui'a a change since it being taken over, I guess, from when you served on the board to now that it's under PAP? And even before Herb got involved with...
I don't know, because I've never seen it since... my first time here was 2006, so I don't have the older history the way Herb does, where he remembers when all this wasn't open. But just from the time that... From 2006, when I first came, to now... What I see is that back in that area in the way back, that's Mauka side of the pond, that used to be all mangroves back there. So I remember when we were first pulling mangroves, it was all back in that area. So now it's been opened, right?
It's very open.
Very open. And then I remember when this rock wall was not as nice as it is now. It's just beautiful, right?
Yeah.
So at certain points, like when we had high king tides, it was flowing over the wall, right? So this is a beautifully done restoration of the wall. And for a while, I think they were trying to use the bluestone because we were getting donated bluestone from the quarry, but that wasn't great. So it looks like they, Herb said they brought in rocks from the west side. These are the kind of rocks you need, the big rocks. That wasn't as nice. So those that rock wall wasn't as nice. And then all back on that end used to be all mangroves. And so over the years, I've seen it been, you know, so the pond itself has gotten, looks like it's gotten larger and larger, right? Because we've removed the mangroves. So only this year, he says what they're doing is they got permit to burn the dried mangroves. So they've chopped off all the mangroves, they piled it there, and now they can burn it, which is a wonderful way, because what we used to do is haul it all away. The guys would be on the chainsaw, and they'd be cutting it, then we'd be passing all of this.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah, and then we'd be passing it, like you make a chain gang, right? And you're passing it from one person to the next, everybody's muddy and dirty, and you're trying to get it to shore. And then they would bring the truck behind to actually haul away the dried, once it dried up, right? Then they would haul it away, and the chippers would come sometimes, and we'd hire the chippers to come and just chip all of the wood. So all that back end, we couldn't see that back end. Now you can actually see it, right? Because beyond all of the dried ones that they're burning now, all of that's open when before it wasn't. I believe that Dave Krupp and others have taken a drone up, and then they've taken pictures of it so we could kind of see over time, I guess, how we've been, it's been, all that mangroves have been taken away, right? So in 2006, it was not like this, no. So every time I would come, you would see, you know, you think that you're not doing enough work because you do 4 hours of work on a work day, maybe 3 or 4 hours, and it's like you feel like you didn't even make a dent, right? And so it's really multiple hands, multiple days over the years. And so you have to, I told my students, when at the end of the shift, oftentimes my students would ask me, I don't think we made a dent here. It doesn't even matter what we do. I says, no. I said, you have to keep coming back. You have to come back and come back multiple years, because if you come back over time, I can tell you, because when I first started coming, we had all those mangroves back there. That's all gone. When I first started coming, we couldn't even see the back end of the pond. All of that was like half the size of what it is now, right? So now you can see the back end of the pond. Before, the only time you could see it was you have to walk on the little path that you go back there, and you could see where it was in that back end, but you couldn't see to this side because it was all blocked by mangroves.
Yeah.
So all the mangroves are gone now. That's amazing. I thought we'd never get rid of the mangroves.
Yeah.
So many work days. So many people. I got many cuts and scars from all of those dried mangoes as we were trying to pass it. I never liked the mango crew. That was a lousy job.
Right, the limu.
I love the limu. That was wet and muddy and fun. So even on a hot day, you feel cool because you're in the water, right? And that was always better than being out on the hot, sweaty, sort of passing those mangroves.
Yeah.
But I've done all the jobs, I think. I even did the rock wall one time. The one time I saw when we brought enough people, we had over 100 people on that work day. I think 120.
Wow.
It was the most we ever had. And so we had plenty of rocks came and got delivered that day. So the point was to actually do like the old days. We had everybody lined up from this side of the wall all the way to the other end.
Right.
And we were just passing the rocks. And I was like super amazed because it was the first time I had ever seen that happen at the pond. I don't know what day it was, but it was amazing because you could see the whole line of people and you go, this is how the Hawaiians built it.
Yeah.
You got a gang of people, a whole bunch, you line them all up, and it's not as much labor if you have many hands, right? And you just have to, the goal was to just stand still and just go like this and twist. It's like good exercise, right? And you're going like this and you're just twisting from one end to the other. But the point is to not step. If you're stepping, that means you've got not enough people, right? Because you want to really just have a chain of people. And that was working really well for a while until the kids started bailing on us, right? So all the adults were fine. The old were great at it. But the kids, they got to go take bathroom break. They got to go get water. Next thing you know, you're walking two or three steps to get your rock over and you're going, what's happening here? You know, but that was a fun day because all we did was just pass rocks, right? And that was pretty cool. And that was an amazing day. Yeah.
Do you know, or maybe just from being a teacher, do you know any mo'olelo about the area or?
I'm not really great. I haven't done the history on this pond and I don't know the mo'olelo. Of the pond. I think I'm hoping that Herb and others know and they've done the research. Although it'd be kind of fun.
Sure,
yeah. No, mine is just from the actual just coming and doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why is preserving the Lopo'ia important for the community, for the seven generations? Why is preserving the Lopo'ia important?
I think it's important because it's one of the few fish ponds left, right? Kaneohe Bay used to have plenty. I think now we have about five left, right? And I think Kaneohe Bay used to have, 40 or something?
Yeah.
So much of it has been, you just look on this side and you see all these homes. I mean, there used to be all kinds of fish ponds all around Kaneohe Bay, right? Most of them have been filled in, after the war, right? After World War II, I think they started filling in a lot of those ponds.
Yeah.
So you look at old maps and how there were so many, right? It's like Pearl Harbor on the other side used to have plenty of fish ponds too, right? These were the two places on this island, and now there's like none in Pearl Harbor side. Mm-hmm. And now we only have about five left on this side. So it's like, it's important because it shows us what our ancestors could do years ago. But now everybody talks about sustainability, right? And how we're going to feed ourselves. And when you think about a large population before contact in 1778, right, and how were we able to sustain a large population? These fish ponds were pretty amazing, and how our ancestors were kind of amazing to be able to pull that off, right? To have all of this fish, right? To have these ponds are just an ingenious sort of engineering feat, right? So I think if we can get them working again, we have the potential of not just remembering the history of what our ancestors did, but learning from our modern science and our modern ways of doing things as well, to use both somehow, so that we can actually bring fish ponds like this under production again, to see that, so we can feed our people, so that we don't have to rely on those mats and containers to bring in all the food,
absolutely.
Right? And so our ancestors, so I always think it's funny, that people always, they're looking to, nowadays, they're looking to our ancestors, to the indigenous people for some knowledge, right? That we have forgotten over the years because we bought in. Our ancestors, you know, had to change with everybody else, and we abandoned all these ways because we, you know, it's easier to just get them at the store. It's easier to do it this other way. We forgot the old ways of doing things. Yet there is something to it. They could support a very, very large population, and these ponds were part of that solution, right? The taro patches as well, right? Was how we were able to feed our people. If only we could go back into that. And this pond, there's a potential to do that, right?
Yes.
And I think we were hoping at one point we could grab the sewage plant behind, right? Because they abandoned that, right, when they redid the whole sewage thing. So they abandoned that, and they used to have these huge tanks, right? And they've since demolished it. But we were hoping at one point that we could actually use those tanks and have sort of an aquaculture. You have the traditional right next to a sort of modern aquaculture. They had these huge tanks, right? So we were hoping that we could do that, and then we find out that they went and demolished it, and that's like, oh. There goes that idea. But, you know, if you could do that, imagine if we could bring these ponds back. I know He'i is already doing it. I know that, is it Mo'oli'i out in Kualoa Ranch? I think they're already doing it, bringing it under production, trying to raise fish there, harvesting it. But we haven't yet, yeah? But it's a solution. It's one of the solutions for sustainability, I think. Absolutely. So that we can actually eat without bringing in mats and containers, right? Because I think we on Oahu especially will be in big trouble. I think the neighbor islands are better. Hawaii, Molokai, Kauai, you know, I think they're a little bit better. Maui got some, kind of like us sometimes, with the overbuilding with the tourism. So I think we depend too much on those container ships and going to the store, and we don't know how to grow our own food. Mm-hmm. So I think this is part of the solution, although it's probably not our generation. It's probably going to be the next generation that tries to get food out of this pond.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be amazing. So it's more like an educational pond at the moment, right? So this is the pond that you have the most, it seems to me that people have the most access to, right? So Kualoa Ranch is owned by private, right? So you got to make arrangements and pay to go and put it in. Or find out, you can, I have made arrangements and I have taken students out there, but you have to make arrangements with their educational department. It's a privately owned one. He'i also owned by Kamehameha Schools, right? So they're bringing that on, and that's a beautiful pond. It's huge, right? He'i Fish Pond. But they have other goals as well, but it's not, it's part of it is production and part of it is education. This pond has only been education for now, right? So we haven't quite gotten it to production. But I think even if we ever do produce fish from it, I get the sense that it's not going to be for money. It's going to be, if we make money off of it, it's only going to be to go back to support the pond and the people, right? Mm-hmm. Because we used to, even when we pulled out all the limu, we pulled out tons of limu and we let it dry in a big pile out there. And then the farmers would come and grab it, and then they would use it for their lo'i because it was good for fertilizer for their lo'i, right? So we recycled it like that, and it didn't cost them anything. We didn't charge them for that. We said, well, it's just good. We didn't want it in the pond and you can use it, right? So this pond to me is always going to be there for education, probably first. And then if we are going to ever produce food for feeding, I don't think it's going to be for like high profit or anything. It's probably going to be for the community, right? Which may not be true for places like Kualoa Ranch or Kamehameha Schools, because those are different, right? It's not a nonprofit that owns it. They have to make money. They have to pay their bills, right? Yeah. It's a little bit different from this pond, who's really just here for... it was this pond that started the whole kahea and that the educational... the curriculum they built, right? They did that here, right? And then it got kind of picked up at the other ponds, right? It was here. So that's kind of the purpose, I think, of this pond primarily. It's mostly educational, I think. Mm-hmm. Come and do and see and learn. I think that's it.
Yeah. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
You have more?
Yeah. What personal contribution are you most proud of?
Oh, what personal contribution am I most proud of with this pond? I don't know. It's not something you can see with the eyes here. It's probably just the people I brought here.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably the students that have come and worked alongside. I remember... it was pretty amazing, some of the students who have come out here with me. And then we get back into class and the relationships that are formed in class because you've served outside. So that service learning model, I would never make it required for my students because I don't want people to come here resentful that they have to be here, give up a Saturday morning, you know, to do this kind of stuff. But I would make it optional and give them an optional assignment they could do, would replace another assignment if they came to the pond. So I made it an incentive, but it wasn't required. So the people who chose to come didn't mind getting dirty, and they could bring their families, which was always wonderful to get to meet their spouses or the kids. And then, so the people I have introduced the pond to, because I said, come and serve in the pond, and we get alongside each other. We're getting all muddy and dirty together. We're part of a work crew or a team. And that, I think, is, I'm hoping that they've had experience. And it's not just the students that I brought, but the faculty. At one point, I was in charge of developing like a professional development leadership program at KCC for Native Hawaiian faculty and for faculty who didn't know anything about Hawaiian culture, to introduce them to Hawaiian culture. And my thing was all about makahana ka ike. It's in the learning that you do. So come with us to the fish pond and let's go out and work together. And then working alongside people who are not from my discipline history, you know, maybe they teach English or math or science or whatever, right? And then they'd never come to a pond before, but because I invited them to come and because I put it in the context of this is professional development, let's talk about it afterwards, and we have these discussions afterwards of what did you learn, right? And people, it was always amazing to me what people would learn from coming to the pond. And it had all kinds of metaphors and all kinds of other lessons that you never expected. So I'd always tell people, don't have these high expectations of I'm going to learn all kinds about fish ponds, you know, and all of that. Come just to experience it. If you come and experience it, I tell you afterwards when we talk about it, all kinds of stories come up, right? Yeah. All kinds of stories, right? And metaphors and teamwork experiences and all of that. So I would hope that by introducing people to this pond in terms of an educational concept, a contact point or a professional development contact point, that they will, this pond is part of their memory of how Hawaiians used to do it, how we can in the future continue to do it, how just an organization and a great leadership of Herb Lee, you know, and that and the organization of doing this, it's possible, right? Hawaiians can still do it, and we have done it in the past. And just this is just your physical touchstone to history, right? But also to provide sort of guidance in how you should work as a team, how you should get to know each other on a different level, how you can, so many different lessons out of this pond. And when I'd read my students' reflections, and when I'd sit around with faculty and talk about it, I was always amazed at how everybody got something different from the pond. It's like the pond had a lesson to teach them that they just needed to be here to experience. And sometimes it was just to get out of the house, stop looking at a computer, and just relate to other people and in an actual place. Because it gave us a purpose, something to do while we were here, and you know, we had to figure it out while we were here. I would hope that that's what people remember, or that's my connection to the pond, is that I brought other people here and that they learned something from this pond. So even if they've never come here again, they came here that one time, and hopefully that made a difference. So that if in the future somebody is talking about, you know, not restoring ponds or getting rid of ponds or whatever, if in the future anything comes up where they can have a say in it, or they'll remember, we came out to the pond. It's important. We should remember this, how the Hawaiians used to do it before, right? They had something going here. Let's make use of this, like, somehow. So I don't know. It's just those people that I introduced the pond to. It's nothing I can see, although there's much limu, but the limu is gone now. Some mangroves, but the mangroves keep growing back up again, right? So that stuff is always not... I think the people who built the rock wall, they probably... They can actually point and say, hey, look what we did, right? I mean, the rest of us, as you pull limu and as you pull and you take out mangroves, it's like, it all comes back, right? So unless you keep at it, it will, if you don't maintain it, those mangroves will come back, right? Because we see those seedlings, they come up and they're everywhere, right? But I think it's the people I met along the way. I can't remember all their names. I can still picture their faces, especially the students, right? Yeah. But I tell you, the relationships that happen in the classroom as a result of the shared experience outside of the classroom, and this was a shared experience outside of the classroom that then made the difference when we got back into the classroom, the different kinds of questions, the different kind of relationships, because we saw each other all sweaty and dirty and muddy and right? And we start asking people questions that we never thought of when we're in class. You never have time to talk story in class. You find out that someone grew up over there, right? You only have time to do this stuff, right? But when you come here, you can start talking because you're kind of boring, you're passing stuff, and you think about what Hawaiians used to do, whether they're making tapa or whether they're carving out something, right? Or whether they're, whatever the work is, I think of the work of our ancestors. A lot of it was side by side, just doing it together. A lot of manual labor goes into it, right? But all the talking and the sharing that goes with that. It's never really quiet. It's kind of, whether you know, whether it's an official kind of passing on knowledge and chant, or whether it's just talking story and telling stories and just relating to each other on a different level. And that's what the pond gave to my students, I think, who are in my class, because it was different, I think, by the time we come back into class. It's like, they're more, they relate to me differently too, because I'm not just a teacher. You know, it's funny thing about working in the pond. I used to joke, working in the pond and working in the tarot patch, and I take my students to the tarot patch too. Interesting, the look of everybody working looks the same, yeah? We're all bent over with our butt in the air, yeah? We all look the same. So at that point, you know, from the highest ranking person, right, to the lowest ranking person, it don't matter, right? We're all equal at that point. All of us got butts in the air as we're bending down, working. And what are we doing? We're working the land. We're working to care for this place, yeah, that's more important than us. There's a sense of equality in that, right? That shared experience of everybody with butts in the air, right? And then we all know what it's like. We're all sweating. We're all working together. And you get to see the personalities. And some people are kind of more bossy than others. They don't really work as a team.
Yeah.
You know, we brought different groups out here for even the Nepali Leadership Institute. We brought the students out here. I'm on that board now, right? And then we brought them out there. You could tell when you got a whole bunch of, like, you got 16 people who all think that they're leaders. Oh, my God. They're super funny, right? They're super funny because who's going to emerge as the leader of the leaders, right? And the different groups we brought out here, some were great. They would work as a team, right? There's a leadership in teamwork. And then others, you could tell the bossy ones would start saying, you do this, you do that. And it's like, oh, interesting, right? And so you have to kind of work through the difficulties, figure it out. And I would watch multiple times as we would do like the line or the crew, because I've done enough of the work crew passing mangroves to know that if you do this way, it's going to be easy. If you do it this way, it's not going to be as easy. So the basic difference was when those who knew how to work as a team knew that if we just put ourselves at the different spots, then the person over there passes it to the person over there and you figure it out, right? But you all have to work as a team for that to work. And the people who were so independent, they didn't want to do that, would grab the mangrove and haul it all the way to the shore by themselves. And I'd look and I'd watch and I'm going, okay, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
All you have to do is unite another 10 people with you, get on this crew and this line and everybody do it. But some people refuse to be part of that crew, part of that line. And they just wanted to do it themselves. And so they're struggling and the effort of pulling it and dragging
and
it the whole way.
Exhausted
by the end. It's like, this doesn't make sense. And then I try to explain to them, why don't we try it this way? Sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't. And you just have to sometimes let them learn by doing it.
Yeah.
Right? Learn by doing. And then they watch and they see. So one line would be like all lines. And then the other side, the other team is like crazy. They're all dragging. Right? And you hope that they'll learn. Right? But some just refuse to.
Yeah.
And so everybody's going to have a different lesson to learn. But there's a lot to be learned about teamwork at this place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And as a team, as a crew leader, because they'd send me out to the different ones, right? Eventually they just knew Colette, just give her Limu. But with different teams, it was so funny that some would listen and some would not. One time they sent me out with a bunch of Castle High School boys. Oh my God, teenage boys.
Teenage
and they gave
boys.
Each of these teenage boys a knife, right? Or like a... So it wasn't a knife. It was sort of a U-shaped tool that we were going to use to what would they call it? We were just scraping away the outside bark around the mangrove. So we found out that there was a better way to get rid of mangroves rather than cutting it down with the chainsaw and hauling it. If you actually take the mangroves that are standing and you girdle it, that's what it's called. You girdle it. You take this tool and you girdle. So you create this band of about an inch and a half or 2 inches around the whole. So you girdle around, you get all the outside bark out for a full inch and a half or 2 inches. And then if you just let the tree stand in place, it will die on its own. And so now you have a line of all these dead trees that are easy. You just leave it in place until you can haul it away, right? So they'll die in place. It makes it easier to haul away because they're all dry compared to wet mangroves that are hard to haul. So they sent me with a crew of about 10 boys, high school boys from Castle High School, into the mangroves, right? With each one with a tool to go and girdle the trees. My goodness, if you got a bunch of 14, 15-year-old boys with a tool, it becomes a weapon at that point, and they start playing sword fight,
right?
And they start doing all this stuff. They start calling me auntie. It's the first time one of them called me auntie, and I had to stop and think, oh, I guess so. They're about my son's age, right? So auntie, no, just girdle the trees. Just do this. No. I said, next time, after I got out of that, Chris, okay, next time you got a bunch of high school boys, send them with a guy. Send them with a guy that's going to just be hard on them, because yeah. I was just anti and they weren't listening to me. And they're having sword fights along the way. And it's like, oh my God, they all signed the waiver. Yeah, I think they all signed the waiver. I was like, oh no, I don't want to do that again. So I think some people are better with that age group. And I think if they had like a larger man that could kind of tell them what to do, they might have listened. But me, I was just anti and they weren't really listening to me. So I thought, oh, that was a lousy job. I'm not doing girdling again, not with high school boys. Those boys are crazy. They're rascals, you know, but they were good in the sense that they didn't mind doing whatever, right? So those are the same boys that would go jumping into that deep end where it comes up to your waist. All the mud comes up to your waist, and then you just can't move after that, right? They just dive right in, right? It's like, ah, what am I going to do? So many of the teenage boys, they just want to learn by doing, making mistakes along the way, too. Yeah. But I'll never do that again. Take a bunch of teenage boys who go girdle some trees. Give them each a weapon. It's a tool, but they see it as a weapon. It's too funny.
Those boys.
A toy. Too funny. Lots of stories, I guess. Lots of people. It's interaction. This is just the backdrop for the interaction with people.
Yeah.
Right? I think they've even brought out, I wasn't the one that actually would help out the crew of all the women, it's correctional facility, the women from the prison, would come and they would work at the back end when we built there was at one point they made a gate, I guess. They took all the old mangroves and they made a protection area back there. They had worked on that. And then they helped on the rock wall as well. They used to bring them out on our community work days, but that got a little...
The workers, the
women from the women's correctional facility, the prisoners, they'd bring them out in these work crews, and they would come out and they'd help out on our pond. And they were really great. They used to bring them out on our community work days, but then that got a little complicated, right? Because the interaction between... And then I remember at one point, one of the women would say, oh, so you know so-and-so, you know my son, or whatever. And I don't think they wanted that interaction going on. So afterwards, they started coming on their own private days, and then Uncle Fred would take them around. They always did beautiful work. They were so proud of their work on the rock wall and on that back end. I'm not sure if it was rocks that they did, but at one point they had built these, they took all the mangroves and they built this, like a fence or something back there. I'm not sure what it was. They had worked really hard on it.
Wow, that's good. It's almost therapeutic.
Yeah, they loved coming out here. Most of the women in women's correctional are part Hawaiian. And this was so important to them because it's like they were out working as a team, and they were in the community doing something, some important work to help restore. And you can see it. So you come back on a regular basis. I think they would come out I forget how often. Was it twice a month? They had to get all the right clearance and the permission. Uncle Fred would be the one that would, and he would buy them plate lunch, right? And so they, because they would work super hard, and he always was real good with them. And they just loved just being out here, you know, and doing it. It's like the way I bring my students out here. I mean, but the women, so much better, before they have to go back in again, that they get to do this work.
It makes them, feel normal.
Yeah, and they seem like so nice, but I think at some point, I'd watched sort of this interactions going on, and I think that they didn't want them coming on the same day as the work group, because they thought, if so-and-so contacts so-and-so, and that's the mom, or whatever, I don't know what goes on, and I have no idea, but I think it was better when they had their own day to themselves. Yeah. They could come out on a regular weekday. Nobody else was here. It was their day to do their work. And they always took such great pride in their work.
Their space.
Such great pride in their work they did, you know.
Yeah.
They really did. They did. So I'm not sure how much it's still left of what they did. But, you know, they did come out. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful day now. Look at it. We got nice sun. We got no rain.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous.
It's really nice.
Look at that. Coconut Island, the Ko'olau Mountains. I love the Windward Side, even though I grew up in Kaimiki. I've been living out Windward Side. We moved out to Waimanalo in 88, and then we bought this home, my husband and I, in 98. So I've been out here for probably longer than I grew up in Kaimiki. So it's more my home now.
I have Ohana in Waimanalo. That's my home.
Yeah.
I mean, but I've never been here, but it's a beautiful space.
Yeah, people don't know it, right? But once you come out here, it's good. Then you're like always part of this, and you know, right?
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful space. Lots of different work we've done here. It's so beautiful that they've done, you know, so much work. Yeah, so much work. And that's the group I'm meeting over there at all the video. That's interesting. That's why they have so many cameras.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's good. Anything else you want to share? Anything that...
Anything else I want to share?
As an oral history project, you know, if someone is going to listen to this or read through the transcript 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
What would I want them to know?
Yeah.
I guess I wanted to know of the many, many hands that have been here. This place is here because of all the volunteers, right? The community that has, and anybody's welcome here. And we've met so many different people who come here. And there's so many different jobs you can do that if you keep coming here that you just, you know, you'll figure it out. I've done all the different jobs, right? I mean, from the little ones, like I remember when we had like little toddlers coming, you know, with their parents. Because I love it when the families come. Because you got, sometimes it's the grandparents and then the parents and the keiki. So you got three generations. But most often it would be the parents and the keiki. And the little ones, like, so you can't, you even have a job for a little one. So the little ones who are toddlers, like about three, four, five years old, those kids, you can actually send them with a bucket that they can hold. And then you teach them about biodegradable and non-biodegradable, right? And you send them out onto the beach areas. And so you're looking for, in your bucket, you're going to put things like plastic, straws, trash. You're looking for trash. So now they have to figure out what's trash. And what can nature actually deal with, right? And believe it or not, we've pulled up a lot of trash, right? From plastic covers from the water bottles. This is why we stopped doing this kind of water bottles and we start going to refillable ones, right? To straws, to stirrers for coffee, yeah. Right? To every conceivable thing, we've pulled out all kinds of stuff from that washes up ashore, right? On the other back end where the water just sort of collects at the end of the last Makaha gate back there, on that one, oh my gosh, you look at the sand, it's very colorful. It's not supposed to be colorful, right?
Aww.
It's a lot of pieces of plastic, right? So, I mean, but the kids, little ones can do this, right? They could do that. So that was a good job for a little one. They could figure out the difference between biodegradable and plastics and things that you have to put in the trash. Or you could send them to pick up all the pods of the mangroves. The little ones can pick up pods for mangroves because you don't want those seeds, for the mangroves to end up back in the pond because it's going to create another mangrove that you don't want. Yeah. So the kids could go around with their little bucket and pick up all the mangroves pods, right? So I just love when you can bring the whole family, right? And that's this pond, that's what's neat about it, right? It's, you can bring a whole family, you can bring your class, everybody's welcome. This pond exists because of the volunteers, because of the people who've come over the years. So I hope 20 years from now, people are still coming and that they're still doing this, right? And they're still maintaining it. Rather than paying someone to do it, it's just the community has invested their time,
yeah.
And their, you know, blood, sweat, and tears or whatever, you know, in this place. So that they feel invested in it. And I think that's why it will survive. And I hope it survives in this wonderful state that it's in because of volunteers, because of community figuring that this is their pond. We belong
yeah.
here, right? We should be having a part
taking
of this.
Taking pride and taking
yeah,
care.
Yeah, right, right, yeah. So I love when the families would come and I never knew who enjoyed it more, the parents or the kids, or the fact that they get to do it together, right?
Oh, no, yeah, and it's making me think my son is turning 3 next
yeah.
month.
Yeah, and he could do that.
He
a little one
it.
Could do
no,
it, right?
I'm just thinking
yeah.
about it. He would love it.
You know, so it's funny because it's in our world today, there's so much screens. People got their earphones on all the time. They're not relating to each other. And this gives you the experience of going back out and doing it. Like our ancestors did years ago.
Yeah.
Except they didn't have to remove plastic, you know. But we have different jobs now that
yeah.
we have to do sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's the whole family. It's everybody. And the kids always love it because, I don't know, for some reason, I think we tell them not to get dirty or not to get wet or not to get muddy. But over here, it's like, go
yeah,
for it.
Yeah.
Have fun. You just have to hope you have a towel and a change
yeah.
of clothes, right? But go for it. Have fun, right? And that's what the kids... it's like it's the kids are surprised, like we could give them, we're telling them to get dirty,
yeah.
right? It's like, go ahead.
It's a good relief.
Yeah,
too,
you know, them. And you're productive, right? And I think that's what's neat about the kids all realize that every single one of them had a job to do. And I think maybe in our world today, we don't give kids jobs. Enough jobs. And so if you're part of the, so everybody has, so the men can go and do the big old hard heavy labor, right? The women can do other things, right? There's a variety of things we can do, and the little ones, even the little ones, can help, right? And just
yeah.
being able to help, I think that's amazing that
yeah.
this pond has done that. I don't know if other ponds do that, but I know I've seen it here multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the kids are so amazing. They just love it. They love getting muddy, they love getting dirty and wet, and they can't wait to come back again, except for the girls that are around, I think it's intermediate,
oh,
early
yeah.
high school, they don't want to get,
yeah.
especially when they're coming with
too
their crew,
yeah.
too muddy, too dirty, right? Those are the awkward age,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
When they don't, you know, we tell them, and we look at their shoes and go, are you sure you want to go into the pond with those shoes? Because they're not going to come out looking like that. So we told you to bring your yucky ones, right? The ones that if it gets all muddy and dirty, you can toss, right? Tabbies, I'd always wear my tabbies. And I went through a couple of tabbies all the times I came. But it was funny to watch them, you know. Those girls are about intermediate. They're getting all kind of girly girl and everything has to stay. Those are the funny ones to watch. They're just they crack me up because they come with their class, and because it's their classmates, they got to behave a certain way, and they, you know. But when they're with their families, different, and they don't have any of their classmates around, they'll act different, right? Yeah. And it'll be okay. But when you're just coming with your classmates, because you got to go back to the classroom, and there's all the girl stuff that goes on, you know, girls and how they can be so cruel. I see many different groups come. It's good fun, good community building.
I think so.
Yeah. I don't know if there's other ponds that do this, but I know that Waikolu Loko is definitely welcoming of all to come. Met lots of people over the years. Done all kinds of work together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's wonderful, this pond. It's been so long. It's almost like I needed to come to the pond to relax, to get away from stress. Yeah? The stresses of work, staring at a computer all day.
It's a lovely break from
Yes, it is. It's a lovely break from the office. So this, I feel a little bit guilty, but not really. Because I've been in the office so much, and there's all this staring at screens. So I'm sure my email will be crazy by the time I get to it, right? But I have it on my calendar, so anybody, my secretary and others can go look. I'm booked for this day from 9 to 3 pretty much, right? That's pretty much the whole day.
Nice.
Yeah. So cool. So, you know, the story about my... I traveled in the footsteps of Queen Kapi'olani.
Yeah, yes,
okay,
yes.
I went on that journey, right? So my sabbatical from April to June. So I was researching. I was working at Kapi'olani Community College. I worked there for 24 years, actually, from 92 to 2016, I guess. And so I taught Hawaiian history from about 97 onward. And they started asking me to do presentations about Queen Kapi'olani, because it's Kapi'olani Community College, right? Mm-hmm. And I was the history teacher. So they said, oh, we got visitors coming from the mainland. Can you do a presentation? That was like in 2002. So then I started researching her, and I started trying to figure out who she was, what she did. Mm-hmm. And there's not a whole lot. I think most people know about Queen Emma or Queen Liliuokalani. They don't know enough about Queen Kapi'olani. So I started going down that route. So by the time I served as department chair, I did 4.5 years as department chair, but I was exhausted, and I knew that after 2 terms of department chair, I needed a break, and I was going to apply for sabbatical, and I wanted a year sabbatical, and so I thought, what could I do? I want to travel. I want to learn about Queen Kapi'olani. I said, oh, she went on this journey all the way to London. I'll do that.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that up as my sabbatical proposal, took a year sabbatical, spent the fall of 2015 researching and digging through newspapers, trying to figure out what she did, where did she go, so I could retrace her footsteps, and then spent from April to June of 2016 retracing those footsteps, traveled to 9 cities, all in the order that she had traveled, around the same time period she had traveled, used the same modes of transportation in general, and so I flew to San Francisco, but I took a train across the continent and to the various cities she traveled to, and then I did a ship across the Atlantic, right? So I wanted to retrace her footsteps, and I blogged along the way. So I did this whole blog, and I'm trying to blog every day. I didn't quite do every day. I did 44 blogs and 56 days of travel to 9 cities, right? So it was kind of crazy, but it was wonderful. I was glad I did it. But one of the things I was doing, because she stopped off in multiple cities, right? So San Francisco, Chicago, she just changed trains. We stayed overnight. Then it was DC, Boston, New York. And then she took a ship across the Atlantic, and she pulled into Liverpool, and then she visited Norwich, the small town called Norwich, and then into London. So retracing that around the same time period. So she left in April, we left in April. She got back in July, because travel time in those days was like 25 days just to get from Hawaii to England, you know.
For us,
it was a little faster. So we were gone for 56 days on the road. She was gone for 106 days on the road, right? But we didn't have that long, 25 days just to get there the way she did. But we retraced her footsteps the best we can. And so when I was in San Francisco, I was trying to figure out, where did she go in San Francisco? One of the places she went to was the Old Mint. So there's the Old Mint in San Francisco. And the reason she went to visit was because Kalakaua had ordered his 1883 coins. So it's the dollar, the half dollar, the quarter, and the dime. He ordered those in 1883 from the San Francisco Mint, right? So she actually went to go visit. She went on a whole tour of the San Francisco Mint and saw how they were making coins and whatnot. And so we went on a tour of the San Francisco Mint. It's still there today. It's not open to the public. They have a few rooms that they sometimes have events in, but most of it's just a solid building that never came down with the 1906 earthquake, and so it's still there. And I didn't know how I was going to get myself into the San Francisco Mint. So this was part of my challenge as I was going to find these places that she had visited. How am I going to get myself into these places, right? So I was trying to find out who in San Francisco could get me access to the Mint. So I come to the fish pond one day, and Andrea, who's a lady, our volunteer, who does all of the registration for everybody when they come in. So I was telling Andrea, I said, okay, I've got this sabbatical. I'm going to leave in like weeks, in like 2 months or whatever it was. And I said, and I don't know how I'm going to get myself into the San Francisco Mint. And then Andrea says, oh, I used to live in San Francisco. I used to, you know, work right across of the Mint. I know some people there. And so she gets on the phone with somebody she knows in San Francisco who works right across of the Mint, who knows the person to contact that's part of the San Francisco City Council, so that they could, so then I got it, she got me in contact with a person to contact so I could get into the Mint, and that's how I got in. So the Waikolua Local Fish Pond was how I got, so this is a weird story, right? So that's the kind of behind the scenes that most people don't know. As they read my blog and whatnot, they don't realize that the craziness that went into getting, finding these places. But that one was just sort of so weird, right? Somebody I know from the fish pond that used to live in San Francisco, who knows somebody who could get me into the Mint. So that's my connection. I got into the Mint, and then I came back afterwards and I told Andrea, I got in, thank you so much, your friends were so helpful, and had all my pictures and my stories to tell. It was kind of amazing. It was just so Hawaii, right? So-and-so knows so-and-so, right, but then right. It's like, that's not just a small island, not just a small Hawaii, but small world. I mean, this is, I had no idea how I was going to get into the Mint, and it was Andrea here at the fish pond who got me in. It's like so wild. And the people there, the lady who took me through on the tour, she had done this whole report. She's like an architect, historian person or whatever. She had done this whole report about the history of the old Mint. It was that only building. You got these pictures that it never came down in the 1906 earthquake, right? Because it's so solidly made. It's made of metal, right? And so she knew the whole history of the Mint and going around and, you know, and she's giving me the tour. And then she had no idea that our Kingdom of Hawaii had minted our coins there at the Mint. She knew that a number of countries had minted their coins at the Mint, but she didn't know that Hawaii had, and that we had coins minted there. It was like brand new knowledge to her, right? Wow. And she's the lady who had the history of the Mint. So then I bust out my coin. I have an actual, I have a hapalua, a half dollar, and I bust out my coin. So they're collectibles now, right? So they melted most of them down around the early 1900s when we became a territory of the U.S., right? They wanted to get rid of all the Kalakaua coins, but the smart people saved them, right? And collected them. Yeah. So we still have collectibles. So I did get, I had an older, so one is not as the mint condition, so it's hundreds of dollars, not thousands like the mint condition ones. And I had my coin with me because I told my husband, I said, I want to bring my hapalua with me, although I wanted to bring an artifact from the past, and I thought it would be fun to bring it to the mint because it was minted there, right? And so I bust out my hapalua coin to show to the people who are giving me the tour, and they got super excited. They had never, they didn't know the story about our coins, they had no idea. And then when they saw my actual coin, they wanted me to take it out of its little plastic, they wanted to take pictures, and they were so excited, they had no idea. And I think it's because, and I was kind of like a missionary about Hawaiian culture, Hawaiian history, I don't know. People didn't know about our past in the history of Hawaii. They didn't know that we were a kingdom. I think people, even in California, don't quite realize that we were a Kingdom of Hawaii and that the Kingdom of Hawaii would have minted coins there. I think that they go straight to, we're part of the U.S., right? And yeah. Hawaii is not, they don't think of it as an independent nation that would have contracted with the U.S. government to mint coins at their mint. So that was super cool. You know, they got all excited, me showing them an actual hapalua, my hapalua that I had. I just thought it was fun. I kept it in my purse, my travel purse, and I just always kept it with me. But it was something, an artifact of the past that I could take to the place where it was actually made and show to the people who know the story about the place, but they didn't know the story about Hawaii. They didn't know the story about our queen. They didn't know the story about our king. They didn't know the story about our coins. So I felt like I was this missionary about Hawaii. It was fun. It was fun. But there's my Waikolua connection to my journey all the way to London. So, cool. So I did a blog, right? So in the footsteps of kapi'olani.wordpress.com. So that blog, it basically was another, I had worked with a travel blog before when I was actually on the road. And then a year when I got back in 2017, they closed down that company. So I had to migrate everything over to a WordPress site. So now it just sits on the WordPress site. It's there. Anybody can see it and kind of it's just my day-to-day, sort of what I was experiencing. This is what the queen did. This is what I did. I saw all kinds of things. I think I found the two trees that she planted, one in Wellesley College in near Boston and one in Rackheath Hall, which is near Norwich, a city in England, yeah, a town in England. So I think I found those two trees that she planted, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, and then I saw this tower. It's in not too far from Norwich at this place called Pine Banks Tower. There's a tower that she ascended, four stories high, and there's a plaque on this tower that says, H.M. Her Majesty, Queen Kapi'olani, ascended this tower 6 June 1887. So that was my favorite place on the whole journey because the tower is still there and they won't tear it down because it has our queen's name on it. And they had no idea about Queen Kapi'olani. They didn't know her story. They didn't know about her. And so I got to tell that story as well. So, yeah, so even all the way, and the place where she planted her tree in England, that place, they didn't know anything about our queen either. They didn't know that she stayed at Rackheath Hall. They didn't know that she planted a tree there. So I brought my pictures with me from her album. You know, the Bishop Museum has it in their archive. So I had these photos of the pictures from her album to show them of Rackheath Hall in 1887 when the queen stayed there. Even the Royal Standard is flying over Rackheath Hall when she was there, at the actual time she was there, because the Royal Standard was flying over Rackheath Hall. So that hall is still there, which is amazing. It's like a big mansion, right? And that is kind of amazing that it's still there. So many big estates or large mansions were torn down after World War One and Two. Just too hard to maintain. You need servants for them, right? And so it's kind of amazing it's still there. That building is actually there. And they had no idea. They didn't know the story about our queen, and our queen had visited there. Kind of amazing. Anyway, you can go to the blog and read all about it. Or watch the videos. So cool. Yeah. Give me your email, I'll send you some links and you can watch some videos or read the Oh, is that like telling us we gotta be proud? The wind's blowing too hard. And Andrea would be very annoyed by this. Andrea was all about no one-use bottles at the pond. She would always make sure we brought the water and the jug, right? And everybody had to bring a disposable, a recyclable one.
That's what I thought.
She was totally against you.
Happening. That's why I brought my.
Yeah, she's totally against this kind. And I can't even open it. My hands are all mucked up. Can you? Are you good with these things? My hands have been bothering me. I've got like this. I don't know what it is. If it's arthritis or what, but I have a hard time now. Grabbing things.
Okay, so I think it's just about 10:30.
Is it?
Yeah, and we're supposed to.
when are we supposed to be, pal?
At noon.
Oh, we got plenty of time. We can talk. Sorry, I can tell you all about the trip. That's my. Sorry, I love Queen Kapi'olani. The more I learn about her, I just love the queen. And there's an interesting story related to fish ponds and the queen as well. She actually had a fish pond where she lived in. So you know downtown, so you work for cultural surveys, so they've done lots of surveys of Kaka'ako area, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the queen actually lived on what is now, so you know where the Board of Transportation building is at Punchbowl and Queen?
Yeah.
So it's right at that corner. Okay, so that whole block from, so Punchbowl, Queen, South, Halikawila, that whole block, that was her property, Queen Kapi'olani's property. So her home used to be right where the Board of Transportation's building is, right? So when she got married to Kalakau in 1863, he was not king. He doesn't become king until 74, right? So where do they move to? They move to her home, right there where she had her home, right? Where the transportation building is today. Yeah. And then where Honuakaha is, that was the name of that property, right? Her property is Honuakaha. So right next to the Board of Transportation, there's a old elderly home now. It's called Honuakaha. And they found a lot of, it used to be a graveyard from the 1853 smallpox epidemic. So they took all the graves and they moved them behind the home into this big old mound, I guess. They put the bones. Anyway, then I think if you go further down, there's a Primo Brewery, and then there's the on South and South and Queen is the fire station, right? And you go around the block, and so Halikawila and South is where my ancestor had a home. So I found out in researching that my ancestor served Queen Kapi'olani, was one of the retainers of Queen Kapi'olani. Mind you, I find this out in 2014, and I've been researching Queen Kapi'olani since 2002, and I don't know why I'm drawn to her story, right? And I come to find out that my ancestor Ka'imihaku actually had a home there, and I know this because the queen had 12 of her servants lived on that property, and she gave them land. Before she dies, a year before she dies, she decides she's going to give them a perpetual lease for themselves and their direct descendants for that land. And so she didn't, I'm thinking about it before she died, so this is like this is on her birthday that she signs these leases, and she's giving these lands to her servants because she knows she's sick, I guess, right? She's had a stroke already. And so I think she's being real smart about her property, and she doesn't want her servants to go homeless. So she's actually giving them land. So they all got these leases. And then Kawananakoa and Kalani and Oli, her nephews, who would inherit the land. They owned the land, but it was being leased to all these people. They actually gave the land deed to my ancestors back in 1902. So basically they said for a dollar, because they used to be only a dollar a year. So for a dollar, you now own it. I sign off these deeds. So I found in the Bureau of Conveyance, they have these documents where it's signed off by Prince Kawananakoa and his wife, Prince Kalaniniole and his wife. These are Kapi'olani's lands that they're now giving over to my ancestor because she was a servant of the queen. So I didn't know this. This is like wild for me. So I'm drawn to the queen's story just kind of... part of it was happenstance. I'm working at KCC. They want me to start doing these presentations on the queen. I start learning about her. But as I start learning about her, I'm attracted to her story, and I don't know what's going on here. Why am I drawn to her story? Nobody seems to know her story. And then I find out that my ancestor was actually working for her. I don't know what she did. Yeah, I think so. I don't know what she did for the queen. I really don't. But I think it's pretty cool because I was thinking, at one point I thought, I wonder if my ancestor ever met the queen. And then to find these documents, it was just pretty wild.
She did more than meet
the queen. Oh, yeah. And the queen actually gave her land. The land, you know. Yeah. And that was amazing. These 12. And there's a thank you letter that the 12 of them signed. And I got it translated because I'm not fluent in Hawaiian. But I know people at KCC who are, right? So they translated it for me. Even the land deeds, I got it translated as well. So it was kind of amazing. And so it's kind of like... The Hawaiian sense is that your ancestors can speak to you in different ways, and I think this absolutely. Is the way my ancestor is probably speaking to me. So, back to fish pond story. That area of Honuakaha, if you actually look at a map, and you'll see that end where her home was, Honuakaha in that area, that's where the home was, but on the back end of it was these fish ponds, and they were all filled in. So the area where my ancestor lived in the 1800s, you know, you're talking the 1890s, right? That's all fill. It used to be fish pond. It's Kaka'ako, right?
Yeah.
And you have salt flats, right? But there was actually a fish pond. So her property of Honuakaha on that back end, Halikawila area, used to be fish ponds, but all of that is filled in. So you look at the maps and pictures of it, you can actually see it.
Yeah.
It's there. Yeah, and that was her land, that whole block. She inherited from her first husband, Bennett Namakeha, right? So she had all of this property from him, right? And so she's young, she's only in her 20s when her first husband dies and Kalakaua, you know, he marries her in 63. She's born in 34, so she was only, she's young, right? 44, 54, right? She's only 20, she's not even 30 yet, right? Yeah, she's not even 30. Anyway, she would have been 30 in 64, right? But she's only 29, so she's only in her 20s when she becomes a widow, inherits all this land, right? So Kapi'olani, that's the person I really like to research, and I've been on that journey. I think I'm the only one from Hawaii to retrace it ever since she went in 1887. That was my sabbatical. Cool. I had a year sabbatical. It was lovely. It was like the most amazing thing I've ever done. Most amazing thing, yeah. And there's a fish pond connection, so there you go. connection. Yeah. So I got back in 16. I got the job at Windward as a dean. And then, so now what I do for fun, people ask me what I do for fun as my hobby. I give presentations about the queen. That's pretty much it. That's what I do. Because I don't get to teach now, because as a dean, right, as an administrator. So people ask me to just cover, you know, I get interviewed for videos, or I go and I make presentations at different places, right? Zoom now, everything's by Zoom now. So yeah. I can have reach to like Arizona and, you know, other places because, you know, you can go on Zoom now and do presentations, right? So... that's my research, right? And you know she was born in Hilo, yeah? Kapi'olani. She was born in Hilo. She has family genealogy from Kamuali'i on Kauai, as well as Kekaulike from Maui, right? So she has that in her genealogy. So she's high ranking, right? But she was actually born in Hilo. I don't know where in Hilo. Somebody must know. I don't know where. But she was born in Hilo.
Wow.
Yeah. You didn't know?
No, I didn't.
You didn't know.
Know.
Most people don't know about Queen Kapi'olani. This is my big quest in life, is to just get people to learn about the queen.
I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. And so even like when I found out that land, right, and when I made that revelation, and by then my dad had passed on. So I think it was, when did I find out? Maybe it was 2015 I found out, because 2015, because he died in February of 2014. He would have thought this was super interesting, because my Hawaiian side comes from my dad, right? And he knew I was doing this whole Kapi'olani thing, and he had seen some of that, and although never my presentations, he had heard about it. But he would have thought that was pretty amazing, because we had this name of an ancestor, but I know nothing about this ancestor. I still don't know what she did for the queen, right? But to find these documents, right? And that's the beauty of our Hawaiian ancestors. They've left us all these documents. They're all in Hawaiian, by the way. But they've left us all these documents, yeah. Right? That you can go and look at the Bureau of Conveyance, and you can see that they're signing off on these land, the land transfers that's happening, right? That's kind of amazing, right? I mean, they're a very sophisticated nation, and they've done it so quickly, right? So you figure that contact happens with Captain Cook in 1778, American missionaries come in 1820 and introduce writing of our language, right? So between 1820 and when she's like traveling in the 1880s, and it's like 60 years, it's not a lot of time, but our country had advanced so much that everything is written now. We have court documents, we have Bureau of Conveyance, all of the land deeds are there. It's kind of amazing that we had advanced so much, and we're recognized by, you know, England and France and the United States and all these treaties with all these nations, right? So even when our queen was there in England, she was treated very well by the Queen Victoria, right? In fact, she got the best seat in the house in all of Westminster Abbey. Our Queen Kapi'olani and Princess Liliuokalani was seated right at the place of honor, right? It was kind of amazing. So, I mean, I just think that history is interesting, and Kapi'olani in particular. And now that I know my connection to the queen, I have to find out more. I don't know. I don't have time to keep doing the research because I'm too busy being a dean. Yeah.
But you want to
I want to know more. I want to know more. I know some. I know pieces. Yeah. I think it's kind of amazing. Yeah. I want to know more. She was very interested in women's education, and college education for women. She was interested in people with disabilities and how do you educate people who are blind and deaf. Right, she visited those kinds of schools when she was traveling. So in these cities, when they'd asked her, "What do you want to see?" she said, "I want to see schools." So she wants to see schools, colleges for women. She wants to see schools for the people who are disabled. She wants to, and then she's also going and inspecting places like prisons and hospitals. This is why she opens up the hospital, Kapi'olani Maternity Home, initially. She sees schools, hospitals, prisons, lunatic asylum. She's visiting all these different places. It's really quite interesting. To me, I was more interested in her journey and all the places she was seeing along the way rather than London. London is interesting, but it's not to me, it wasn't the most interesting part of the story. The most interesting part of the story was actually her way there and all the places she visited and the stories that unfolded. Yeah, so that's what I was focusing on. That's why retracing her footsteps and trying to find buildings that she saw and that she stayed in was important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in England, it's like jackpot because, you know, they got old buildings. They're still around. Not so much in the U.S. I mean, the old Mint was a big one in San Francisco. But there were others, like I think she went to Mills College in San Francisco. She visited that, so that was still there. Mm-hmm. Right. So you don't have to interview somebody else?
I do, but not till after lunch.
You give us a lot of time. Yeah. Yeah.
At first, we thought it was just going to be for an hour.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Sometimes even an hour is...
plenty.
Yeah.
Yeah, but now they give you more time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think we're okay.
We think we're okay? We did all the fish pond stuff?
Yeah. I asked all the questions.
Okay. Okay.
I touched on what we needed to touch on.
Right. Yeah.
We're okay. Mm-hmm. We can head back.
Yeah.
All right, because are you being videotaped?
I think later on I am being videotaped, right?
Okay, I think we're doing this.
We're going to swap, yeah?
Switcheroo.
So I think that's why I'm sticking around for lunch. They're going to get a Zippy's lunch, and then we're going to switch, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to give you my card, and you can email me if you want.